Living in a scientific age, we need citizens who know enough about science to make intelligent decisions about what they do. We've used science to prolong life, to increase security and happiness.
Your sound,
but it can also be used for destruction. Are we going to use it constructively?
Shh. Nobody noticed.
It'll be up to you, and you too.
Were you saying something to me? It was my audio was on.
Yes, it was playing over the. Sorry. It was playing over the speakers here.
Double whammy in there. But do you know what the difference is between a cat and a comma?
I do not know what the difference between a cat and a comma is.
Well, one has claws at the end of the paws, and the other has a pause at the end of a clause.
No, see, I wanted to be more fully engaged in that joke, but I'm having, I think what, I'm experiencing a little bit of your tinnitus type thing where I'm just hearing this really awful grating.
I injected like, that into the audio feed so that you could experience tinnitus.
Well, and it's, I think it's a little different because mine is just this irritant, like a noise I've never heard that just won't stop. Let's see if I get, oh. Can you hear that too?
Oh my god!
It's
gosh.
Just been going on and on and on, and every.
I can almost hear it now.
I can never stop hearing that. That woman will be screeching in my head for for quite some time.
You know, I before the episode we reviewed a judge. What's it?
I have no idea. I've only seen a picture of her. I had no idea.
Fox
who,
News.
Is she a lawyer or is she an actual judge? Or
yeah.
Are they just saying she's a judge? And
right. She's judgy.
She's
judgmental.
She is very judgy. Anyway, yeah. So we watched that before and it was just a terrible experience. I mean, I'm not used to watching any sort of cable news or anywhere, so it's always jarring to watch it anyway, just because of the way everybody does everything. But yeah, that was especially unpleasant. Well, welcome to another episode of the Mark and Todd Cast. I am one of your hosts, Todd Workhoven. With me, as always, is Mark Middleton. How are you, Mark?
I'm really well.
Good. This is episode 80 already.
Holy cow! I know. 80 episodes.
That's pretty crazy.
It's deep.
And after all, I think. In this whole 80 episodes, I don't know that I've done this. I think I've done this once. But this last week, I felt like my spirit was broken because I just...
Go on.
Do tell. Because I had to finally break down and order something off of the internet.
Yes.
I had to go on to Amazon and I had to order my Newton's Cradle for my friend Liam and a couple of manga books for my friend Devin. It's their birthdays coming up. And
the internet's not a fad, Todd.
Is it here to stay?
It's here to stay.
We're going to cyber for the rest of our lives.
Yep.
Anyway, let's move on to some news. The first two things are kind of follow-up stories in a sense that we've covered them before but are happening now. Starting April 1, all of Oregon bottle deposits will go up to 10 cents. So even if the can says 5-cent deposit, you will get 10 cents back. And when I was reading about it, they... I cut it off here. So the doubling of the deposit was decided by the Oregon legislature nearly 5 years ago. The fact that it will take effect this April was decided last summer when the state hit the trigger of having less than 80% of cans and bottles returned for two consecutive years.
Hmm.
So Oregon was the first to adapt the bottle refund in 1971 as a way to encourage recycling.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 others do the same. But they had to go back and specifically write in a new clause that said... even if it says 5 cents on the can, because they wanted it to be so black and white that,
right. Oh,
that
nice.
They had to add to the law. So yeah, that'll be happening. Colin is very excited because we saved cans to bring back to Safeway. And so now I told him we're going to be getting double the money.
Nice.
So that'll be exciting. I'll be able to pocket that other half because he doesn't know to count money. So another follow-up story, the Cracker Barrel is coming to Tualatin. Yeah. I remember reading about it a long time ago, but on Monday, April 17 at 6 a.m., the Tualatin Cracker Barrel will open off of Nyberg Rivers Shopping Center. And I don't I should know better because I'm kind of in that area now, but that's by the Cabela's, but I don't know if it's in the same shopping center or if it's one down the road. I'm not sure where it is, but next time you're in Tualatin after
Tualatin
April 17.
Sure has evolved in 10
totally.
Years.
Well, remember, and I'd forgotten this until a couple months ago, but when you take the Tualatin-Nyberg exit off of I-5, there used to be...
Jiggles?
There used to be Jiggles, but before Jiggles lasted the longest out of everything there,
yeah.
Because before that, across the freeway from Jiggles, there was this hotel motel thing that mm-hmm. looked like this old white horse ranch type thing.
The Sweetbriar Inn.
Yeah, that's right. I had brunch there once with my mom and dad after church. But
exactly.
So yeah, I was thinking about that the other day. But yeah, that's really, really changed with that Cabela's and the Red Robin is there now. And the it's all very upscale down there with a fancy Tualatin. What do they call people from Tualatin, do you think? Tualatiners?
Tools.
I tried to get a thing when I lived in Tigard. I tried to get a thing going that we were the Tigardians, but it didn't really catch on. Anyway, moving on. Real life RoboCops will soon replace human police. Robot police were once science fiction fantasy, but soon the real thing will be patrolling the streets of where do you think, Mark?
In Philadelphia?
That's right. In the United Arab Emirates in Dubai.
Wasn't Philadelphia where RoboCop was based?
No, I think that was Detroit.
Detroit. All right.
Yeah, so members of the public will be able to report crimes to the multilingual police robot using a touchscreen on its chest. So if you are getting stabbed or shot, you can... Hello?
Please.
I do not understand your request. If it's anything like Alexa, I don't understand that. Would you like to buy the Gin Blossoms album off of iTunes? No!
No.
But I put a little picture of the robot in my thing. So if you wanted to put it up on the screen for people watching, but the friendly robot, which can salute and shake hands, can also be used by members of the public to pay traffic fines and submit paperwork. So yes, there's our traffic robot. It looks like something out of Doctor Who, and by Doctor Who I mean like the 70s Doctor Who.
Right.
Like not even the new one. Look at the hands on that. Yeah. I wonder if that's to choke someone out.
Yeah. The bottom looks like that character from the original Star Trek that was just the
guy in the box that would beep.
Right. Beep once for yes and twice for no. Because that's how far technology evolved at the time. And then the top half just looks like a really bad cosplay of a robot.
It does. And
with
I mean,
an iPad on its chest.
Yeah. And I guess the biggest thing that they're going to would be useful for is just to have a roving camera. I wonder if that has attached, if it's molded on or if it's just.
The hat fits on its head like hats fit on your head. It's
jauntily and off to the side.
It's 3 inches above where normal people have.
With normal heads.
Yeah.
But yeah, those will be patrolling the streets of Dubai. They want to have, in the same article, one said they wanted to have a completely robotic police force by 2030. But then two sentences later, it said they wanted to have 30% of its workforce to be robot police by the year 2030. So we'll see.
Derek Jesser, of course. Rest in peace, Jiggles.
R.I.P. Jiggles. Yeah, that place lasted a long time. Do you remember they always used to run on ads on the radio star,
really?
Rick and Richard's radio star. Oh, yeah. The best Wiggles are at Jiggles.
Oh, yes. I do remember
so
that.
So sad. Because that's their whole thing was that they were the 18,
right?
There was no alcohol there. It was just
for
sad losers in training who weren't quite ready to go to the strip club yet.
Losers in training or, you know.
Dudes.
Yeah.
Dudes. Hey, dudes, let's go to Jiggles.
And so in the same vein of robots, robots are now delivering food in Washington, D.C. And
ooh.
So you can order on Postmates.com. And so I went onto the website and the only address I knew
in
Washington.
Is Postmates a known entity?
Yeah,
like,
Postmates
is
like a Grubhub or a Delivered Dish. Or
a Grubhub or a Feedback. You know, one of those... trough the fillers. It's, you know, a place that brings food to you. A mouth.
You've never heard of Grubhub?
No.
They deliver food.
Okay.
Deliver
city,
dish.
You city people live a lot different life, yes. life than I do down there in the country.
So Postmates, you go on, you tell them your address. And so I put in the only address I knew in Washington, D.C. So we could send a robot with some chicken wings to the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, which would be amazing. But hello.
Oh my gosh.
And
they will be warmly accepted, I'm sure.
Yeah, so they I'm going to pull up a picture here real quick. So they're kind of ankle size, not ankle size, like shin size.
Oh, shin size. Oh, weird.
And so they're
and of course they'll never be stolen or destroyed or thrown off overpasses or
graffitied
on. They actually had little robots like that in Demolition Man.
They did.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
Except they were their food recycling robots.
Was that, there was also a movie with Sylvester Stallone that was a futuristic movie.
Cobra?
No.
Judge Dredd?
No. I'll get it. It was kind of an off. It was an off
Broadway. Over the top.
But they had little robots as
Rhinestone?
Well.
Rhinestone?
It could have been.
Rhinestone with Dolly Parton? It was that one?
It was that one.
The futuristic movie starring Dolly Parton?
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know how these work specifically, but it arrives and tells you that there's food inside and open up the lid, get the food out, and
wow.
it goes on.
Who's behind it? Oh, you said that, what, a food bag? Feed bag?
So there's a company that's making these robots, and then Postmates.
Is there a reasonable, like, are people expecting that this is going to work?
Yeah.
I mean, technically, technically I understand that, yes, it can go from path A to path B.
Right.
But in reality, no, that's not, that thing will be parted out by the second block and up on cinder blocks. Taco-less.
That would be amazing, by the way.
All right. Well, moving on. Scientists use graphene to power electronic skin that can feel. This from London. Scientists have found a way to power an experimental kind of electronic skin using solar energy in a further step to develop prosthetic limbs or robots that have a sense of touch. Powering those systems is a challenge, but researchers have developed a way to use graphene, an ultra-thin form of carbon, to generate the electricity via solar power. The graphene is one atom thick. Is strong, highly flexible, electrically conductive, and transparent. I mean, that just, like, that is literally just magic.
Yeah.
One atom thin and, like,
It's crazy.
And so so it can give them a skin-like touch that would make them even more useful. Touch-sensitive electronic skin could also be used in robots to enhance performance and help the machines detect potential dangers when interacting in humans, which just means they'll know where we hurt and how to hurt us more when they eventually revolt.
Wow. To get something one atom thick, like, I know that they can gold leaf, there's a process that they can get three atoms
oddly
thick.
Enough, I just watched a video on that this past week.
And they can do that manually with, like, by human touch.
By presses. And
yeah, it's crazy. And graphene is, like, graphene, 3D printing, autonomous vehicles, and AI are, like, the four things that are going to change our world.
So, and I think they're going to have to solve the problem with 3D printing that they're having now, like when you get a little toy made or whatever, how there's something that needs to happen between when you get kind of the chunky blocky thing out of the 3D printer that is obviously just, you know, line upon line on top of each other,
right,
as opposed to getting something that was molded,
right,
you know, from a, so there's gotta be, 'cause right now, every time, I feel like every time the consumer sees, like, ooh, I 3D printed this, like that little Pokemon thing I have, it's like, oh.
Oh, I can tell.
It's like buying the off-brand one. So I'm there either has to be a shift in that technology, or there has to.
And that's like in the 80s, I had a home printer, you know, and it was a dot matrix.
Oh, yeah. And you can make banners if you had the special program that made it like 900 pages long, and you can hang it on the wall.
What was the name of that? It was like,
wasn't Page
Print Shop?
Print shop. Yeah, I think so.
Print shop. I made so many banners in print shop, and
it's because you were the nerd in there. It was you, Mark. Can you make us a banner for Drama Club?
Exactly. I was too much of a nerd to be in Drama Club.
No, yeah, you were never invited. You were just told to make the banners. Right. Just slide it under the door.
I know. Sorry. So with that, I got you a couple gifts.
Ooh.
And
I forgot about the
little
gifts.
Reveals. I did too. And I thought I'd just inject these. So both of them are mouth related. So go with that.
I'm going to open this before. This one feels like a an Egg McMuffin.
It's not.
It is not an Egg McMuffin.
Okay. So this is an exercise device. It's made to strengthen the jaw muscles. It's made by the Japanese.
This
I saw it on a Japanese commercial.
Absurd. Yeah. And
So you put it, you bite on it.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and
so essentially, and, for people listening, it is picture a pair of the crazy wax lips, like those silly huge wax lips that you buy, but then it's also got a big bite guard on it so that you slip it, and it's made of silicone.
And it's in full
silicone. I can never remember this.
Silicone. And it's in full operatic.
Has this been washed?
Oh, yes, it has. So, for the record,
no, do not reach for your camera
because the camera's being used. Wait, make sure that the lips are the right. So there should be.
Okay.
Yeah. So. So you got a bite on it. It's not just for your lips. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, and so you can talk like it too.
Right. And so it's used to exercise your jaw.
Of course.
And strengthen your facial muscles.
It does look, it has that ridiculous blow up doll, like perfect circle. Mouth.
Yes.
That is so absurd.
So it's a Japanese
mouth strengthener.
Mouth strengthener.
I will take it. Yeah, tool. I will put a picture of this probably as the main image for the show unless something else comes along, which I don't think it will.
Okay. And also
oh
for
my
the
gosh,
mouth.
My mouth is, my cheeks hurt now from all that
all
exercise.
All that exercise.
McRib is back. It's an Austrian jaw harp. Oh my goodness. So, I am going to have a full cantina band in my bag. I'm ripping it open. It's a,
a jaw harp or
about
a
it forever.
Jew's harp.
A Jew's harp, depending on your level of racism. It is from Austria. Oh, let's see if it all comes back to me. My dad will be so proud if he's listening to this. Dad, this one's for you. What should I play? I forget how to hold this.
I don't either. Perfect.
So you can get good enough. That's harder to play than I remember. There's a way to hold it, but you make the notes with your mouth, and then you twang the little piece of wire. But the trick is to not smack your teeth like that.
Perfect.
Ooh, that is awesome. Well, thank you. Oh, and this packaging is pretty great,
it's
too.
It's an alto.
So there's different ranges.
Yeah,
okay.
There's absolutely
yeah.
different tonal ranges. And this one got really good reviews online where I buy everything.
So. Oh, it's you place the harp against your teeth. Oh, that's your doorbell.
Mine's my doorbell. It's probably the tamale lady. We're not getting tamales today.
Oh, well, today at least.
Let me check out the window really quick.
I can entertain people with, I'll see if I can play the final countdown on my... on my new jaw harp. Yes. All right. I need to.
Today.
Oh, no tamales for us today.
No.
Oh, I hit my teeth again.
Oh, that hurts yeah. When it doesn't. Or when
it's
you get your
smaller
lip
smaller than
cut.
I remember, but I guess I was a child the last time I held it.
Your mouth, your head size hasn't changed since then, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun.
Awesome.
I'm
going to
practice on that. Well, thank you very much.
There you go.
That is very, and I can put the jaw
right
with the jaw harp by these giant
lips,
rubber lips.
Right on.
I'm glad I opened the jaw harp second.
Yes.
All right. Well, moving on. This story, I'm hoping, actually, I asked our friends over on the Not Nerd podcast, since they do a lot of tech stuff, do tech stuff, to check this out. But there's a story been going around that I'll read, and it's a little longer than we usually do. But it's a vote about internet service providers selling your web browser history and all of that information to advertisers without your knowledge. So the U.S. Senate voted to eliminate the privacy rules that required the ISPs to get their consumers' explicit consent before selling or sharing their browsing data and other private information with advertisers and other companies. The interesting thing about that, these rules were just put in place in October. So it was at the very end of Obama.
Right.
And I'm assuming just kind of shoved under the radar at the last minute. And we didn't have anything before that. But that what Obama passed was opposed by the FCC's new Republican majority and Republicans in Congress. So they used the power to override that. So the House would need to vote on the measure before privacy rules are officially eliminated. President Trump could also preserve the privacy rules by issuing a veto. If the House and Trump agree with the Senate's actions, ISPs won't have to seek customer approval before sharing their browser histories and other private information with advertisers. So it was a vote from 50 to 48, completely along party lines. It was that sounded like my jaw harp. That was a sound that just emanated from Mark's throat. It's like the parrots that I think we played on a show once, or not the parrots, the birds in the Amazon that can make the camera noises and the car alarm sounds. They can mimic
chainsaw.
I was watching that video again this week. Anyway, so they're arguing back and forth. So the Senate action would allow Comcast, Verizon, Charter, and other broadband providers to take control away from this. So this is the people that are arguing against it. So blah, blah, blah. Few consumers have any choice of their internet providers is what Senator Ron Wyden, who is from Oregon, said. So that way, because of that, their only choice may be between giving up their browser history for an internet provider or just going without the internet. So this article goes, it was on Arts Technica, which I think is a fairly reputable website. But you can learn more about it. And like I said, I'm hoping to learn more about it myself. But that's kind of the broad strokes of it.
Yeah.
Sounded like it's always been okay for them to sell our information to anyone they want without our knowledge, including our browser history, which I guess I didn't fully realize. But I guess, yeah, I mean, you're just giving it to Google. And so they're trying to repeal it now, even though it's only been in effect, which probably means it hasn't really been in effect at all since this past October.
So it's notable. So your ISP, that we're not talking about Google in this case, we're talking about Comcast for us here, or your, how you connect to the internet. So a couple notes: if you use a secure connection, when you go to Google, the browser bar turns green over on the left, and the address is https://. Any connection like that, anything that you put on the page, that if you type in your username and password, for example, on something and log into somewhere, as long as that connection is secure, that data is not being transmitted, but the URL that you are at is. And so if you're logging into your Pornhub account the specific data on the page isn't transmitted of specifically which video, other than the fact that you're at a specific URL.
Right.
So all of the URLs, anything that's in the address bar, will be transmitted no matter what. And the ISPs have access to that.
Wow.
Anytime that you use a non-secure connection, technically they can capture that as well. And that's a possibility. It's just part of the data stream when it's not encrypted. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about like browser history and that kind of data. But if you use a VPN, a virtual private network, you can basically create a tunnel through your ISP to another ISP that may or may not collect that information. So there's VPNs out there, like BT Guard is one, and you connect to BT Guard with a secure connection. Now Comcast can't see where I'm browsing or what I'm browsing, but BT Guard can, because I'm connected to their network, but they're in Canada and they've got all these claims on their website of they don't store anything that could be passed on to anyone.
Right. So theoretically, then, if you have a VPN and you'd go to Google or whatever, you search sandwiches because you're shame eating or whatever.
Right.
Is that, I mean, that because you typed it in Google, Google has that information. It's not
Google
like it's
has
all
that information.
Secret.
Right. And depending on what.
Or are you anonymous to Google?
Depends. If you ever log in or use an IP address that you have logged in before or something, you are not anonymous to Google. They know that you are returning to Google. You've used another service that you've identified yourself. And
okay.
So Google is able to identify who you are and that you've your shame eating sandwiches. If you hit that search and the Google search changes to google.com/?q=sandwiches, that URL shows that you were searching for sandwiches no matter how encrypted your page was.
Okay.
And so if it gets into the URL, it is insecure. If it stays on the page and the page is secure, then that stays secure.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm like you last week during the lengthy conversation about the Oxford comma that me and Brian excitedly had. I almost made it to the end of that. I just wish there was a browser that was like, none of our business. And like, but there is not. And that's why, just like my Hulu and Netflix, I use your account at Pornhub.
Right. Perfect.
It's super weird. All right. Moving on. Parrots flying high on drugs are annoying farmers by plundering their poppy fields. The parrots swoop down in silence in the open fields, having learned not to squawk, and frantically nibble off the stalks below the pod before they are spotted. Videos show them returning to high branches where they gorge on the plant, leaving them sleeping for hours and even falling to their deaths. The birds hit between March and April. This is in India, and the farmers cannot keep them from ravaging their poppy fields for a cheap high. Ooh, you'll like this. I have a time to cut this article down, but it is a margarita. But somebody made a cloud that rains tequila, so they made
what?
This little enclosed, like, table-sized box that they, you know, monkeyed with the temperature and what they put in it, and they are able to make little clouds that rain tequila in this little, in a art gallery in Berlin. So the contraption was synced with local weather patterns, so whenever it rained in Berlin, the tequila cloud would rain too.
Yes.
The alcohol-infused clouds is actually tequila-based mist held together by a plastic container that helps the mist keep its cloud-like shape. Use ultrasonic humidifiers to vibrate the tequila at a frequency that turns the alcohol into mist, which is
just
that
like
little,
my little
machine thing that intrigues
weird.
Me for...
Right.
Anyway, so you can go
I
watch
tequila
it rain
clouds.
Tequila. And one last thing here, and it was kind of a Portland-based thing. There's a play. Have you ever heard of Run, the day camp for dogs?
No.
It is, if you go to daycampfordogs.com, it is a place in Vernonia, which is maybe a half hour, 40 minutes away from downtown Portland here, in the middle of nowhere on a kind of little mountain road.
Nick and I are considering getting married there.
Oh, yeah. It's like a picturesque, totally picturesque little town. But for $40 a day, I believe, they will come to your home or office and they will pick up your pets. They will bring them to their huge, like 40-acre fenced-in outdoor forest park pond stream area. They will run the dogs around all day, give them a bath when they're done, and then bring them back to your house. So, yeah, and they have a great video, too, of just all of the dogs running around. And so all the dogs get to go to Vernonia for day camp.
That looks awesome.
And then come back home. So, yeah, the website is daycampfordogs.com. So,
yep.
It's a pretty really good cool. gig if you can start. I mean, because it pick up a bunch of people's dogs, run out there, play with dogs all day.
That'd be fun.
Ooh, founded in 1996. It's been around for a while. But it was a good year. Good is that year. What you just said?
Yeah. Good year. It's my first full year out of the Navy. It was a good year. Cool. Well, a few days ago, March 24th, today is the 26th. 2 days ago was the anniversary of the birthday of a guy named John Harrison. John was born in 1693 on March 24th.
So, 1693.
So he was born in the late 1600s, and he was a carpenter. He followed his father's footsteps as a carpenter and was a very skilled carpenter in England. And he was 14 years old. When he was 14 years old, there was a disaster at sea in Great Britain, the most significant, the worst maritime disaster in the history of the British Isles. 1,550 sailors lost their lives because of bad weather and improper navigation. They thought they were in a safe area, and they were not. They were.
Okay.
They
this isn't like in the North Atlantic, I would imagine.
This was super... actually, south of Great Britain. They were actually coming back from the Mediterranean. So they had passed Gibraltar, and they thought they were at a location just off of France, and they were at a location that was further to the west, and they were near the islands of Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y,
okay.
Scilly, and they thought they were just off the coast of France in Ushant. Mm-hmm.
Gibraltar?
I barely knew her.
Nice. And so they lost, they had 19 ships, they lost 4 in these islands, and so 4 ships of men perished, and of those 4 ships, they lost 1,550, and only 13 people survived off of those ships.
Wow.
And so the Parliament in Great Britain set up a new... they established what's called the Board of Longitude, and in Great Britain they pronounce it longitude.
Is there a controversy with the longitude?
Exactly. So, the first of all, the disaster at in the Isle of Scilly, the Scilly naval disaster, had the leader of that fleet.
The Scilly naval disaster.
The leader of that fleet had the most amazing name that I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah.
His name was Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel. Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel was leading. Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel.
Admiral Sir Cloudesley.
Cloudesley Shovel.
Shovel is what threw me.
Right.
It's like the least British pompous sounding name ever.
Cloudesley Shovel. Yeah. So Admiral Shovel was leading his men, and this is early 1700s.
I was going to say recontextualize because early... I completely lost my train of thought with Shovel.
Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel. Okay. So up until the middle, actually late 1700s, the way that you would navigate, on the globe, we have latitude and longitude or longitude. Latitude are the lines that are parallel to the equator. And those are really easy to calculate where you are on the latitude scale, because especially in the northern hemisphere, because if you're north of the equator, you can see the North Star. And so if the North
unless you're Todd, who can never figure out where it is,
if you're a maritime navigator, you can always find the North Star as long as you have weather on your hand.
Right.
If the North Star is directly straight above you, you are at 0 degrees north. And if it is at the horizon at 90 degrees, you are straight at the equator. And you can figure out, based on the ascension of the North Star above the equator, exactly where you are latitude-wise.
Is that so what the sextant does?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So so it looks at the horizon and looks at the North Star, okay. And then they pull it aside, and it's got a little compass on the on the side, and you go, oh, we're at 15 degrees, 15 minutes, and you know where you are on the map, on the y-axis of the map.
Okay.
But you don't know the x-axis, because we rotate the star, and so our position in the solar system rotates, the moon is revolving around us. And so it's not a simple, let me point at that thing, measure that other thing, and I know where we are.
Right.
And so because of that disaster, they set up the board of longitude, and they set up a ransom of 20,000 pounds at the time, as worth today's dollars, about $3.5 million, as a bounty for anyone that could devise a device that would calculate the longitude of a ship, and they had varying degrees of accuracy. You would get 20,000 pounds if it was within 1 degree. You had you could get 15,000 pounds if it was within 1.5 degrees. You know, all these things.
It's like the Warren Buffett March Madness bet.
Exactly. And I watched a docudrama on this, and the array, I don't know how many of these are fictionalized, but the array of other crazy ideas that people came out with at the time. I mean, there was a lot of the closest that we could get was lunar navigation that says, okay, the moon is at this point in the sky, and we can do a bunch of calculations and look at a bunch of tables and go, based on where it is and what star it's next to and what time it is, then we know roughly where we are.
Where we
but,
are.
But that was wildly difficult and inaccurate.
Right.
They just couldn't get the accuracy that they needed. And so they would find themselves 500 or 1,000 miles off of course. And so they would miss an entire continent. You know, if you missed Florida, you would end up in the Gulf of Mexico, and you couldn't do anything with that. Like you couldn't
find the Fountain of Youth.
Exactly. And so that it was critically important to find that information. And there was this guy, John Harrison. He is a carpenter, and he started making clocks as a hobby. And as a 20-year-old, he devised a device that would compensate for the rocking and rolling of a ship and temperature and humidity changes that the device would be in, and be able to keep accurate time. Remember, at the time, the only accurate measure of timekeeping was the sun is directly overhead, and I can use a stick to find out when that is,
right?
And that's noon where I am.
Still in the late 1700s? I mean, they had clocks.
That's one way, and the other one was a pendulum clock, which you could not use on a ship because of the rocking and rolling of a ship. The pendulum was useless. And so
this pendulum is useless.
Right.
Do you know, sidebar, at the Oregon Convention Center, they have one of those things when you walk down and it's the pendulum, the earth pendulum or whatever, and it knocks over the different things, which I was fascinated.
You sent me a text to remind me to talk about this on and the show, and we
both completely forgot.
Yep.
Well, follow up the next day, I went to ask the security guard, like he was going to know. I'm like, tell me how this magical thing works. And he was like, well, this one doesn't. So the one at the Orca Convention Center is not like a working one. It's just there to show like that there are those things. Yeah. It's a replica of something or other. And he's like, yeah, they, cause I, oh no, that's what I asked him. I asked him how those things raise up again. Cause I couldn't see any mechanisms.
Right.
The little things they knock down. He's like, there aren't any. What? They just stay like that. So spoilers.
Okay. So, so that might be true. So there is one in the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles, for example. And
at the Smithsonian too.
Yeah. And at Reuben H. Fleet Science Center in San Diego. And there, so the concept behind those is a pendulum swings, and if it's swinging in a straight line, it will continue to swing in a straight line even when the earth that's it is on rotates. The pendulum will continue to swing in that straight line regardless of the earth spinning under it.
Okay.
So if I rotate, if you think about this spinning like this, and I'm rotating the entire base, well, it's going to continue spinning in the angle that it was.
In essence, the clock face is rotating, not the clock hands.
Kind of.
So that's what's, and then it eventually lines up with the, okay, I see.
Right.
Boy, that's weird.
Yeah. Oh. And so,
our magnetic pendulum.
Yeah. And so if this is spinning this way and the earth is spinning under it, then
boy, that's weird.
It looks like it's rotating and knocking over those little blocks.
Right. See, that's what I thought it was happening. I thought the pendulum was being swung into those different trajectories instead of the, because I could swear that they have one at the Smithsonian where it looks like they're like set on the floor.
Right, exactly.
But wouldn't the base have to spin then?
Well, the base is spinning because the base is connected to the earth and the earth is spinning, but the pendulum is staying in one place.
I don't like that at all.
So there's that.
All right, well, there's a little side tangent for this story.
And then,
So he figures out a way to tell time on the boat.
Yeah, it's a massive device. He goes on board with it, and it responds really well, really close, but not close enough. And the Board of Longitude kept being overly critical of everything. So they put this prize out of 20,000 pounds, and they kept like moving the bar a little bit or taking. It was an act of parliament, so they couldn't change the act, but they would take a word that was slightly vague, like it needs to be usable. And so they're like, well, you have to make three of these now to show that we can make them and they're usable. And it was like, I just made one and that was the requirement.
Right.
Like over and over again, this board was, and he used, he pursued this prize for more than 50 years. This one prize, like his life's mission was to solve this problem.
And what was his name again? I keep getting confused with Sir Cloudy, Cloudy von Shovel.
John Harrison.
John Harrison.
Yeah.
So simple.
And he had a son, William Harrison, and William was his partner in the development of this for 40 of those years, basically.
Not to be confused with President William Henry Harrison, who died in office after 30 days.
Exactly. So I'm going to cut forward to the 1940s. In the 1940s...
Is it a reveal of any sort of of what he built that was working?
No. So in the 1940s...
Wait,
yeah.
What?
I'm cutting forward because...
I'm having a stroke, I think.
No, there's a guy...
well, I was going to ask a question about the device he used on those boats that worked. You said it was in a... Are we keeping that a secret of what kind of... Okay, so what was it that he was able to do?
So he just used a series of... For every pendulum swing, there was a counter swing. It was a series of actions and reactions in the device. And so it was really big. And if you tilted it, the pendulums still swung the right way.
Swung.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like he built it like a Steadicam for the most part.
He built a Steadicam for a pendulum. But what he didn't take into account was the circumfugal rotation. When they did turns, there was a different... They accounted for the left-right action.
Okay.
But they didn't account for the momentum that happens in a turn.
Okay.
And so they... which only accounts for a tiny fraction of a second during that turn, but... Over the course of a month travel from Great Britain to the West Indies, that would account for many seconds, which accounted for many, many miles of being off.
Right.
And so it blew the thing. So and so each time he had to go back to the board, they gave him a grant to kind of continue. So they give him like 500 pounds at a time. Of the 20,000 that would count against the 20,000 pound reward, and have him do more research. And he did this for more than 50 years.
Jeez.
So this guy named Rupert, after World War I, purchased a estate in England that he found the original devices that John Harrison had built. And he refurbished them. It took more than a decade to do this. And his relationship went sour and he went insane and all this stuff. Like crazy, crazy story.
That's the rest of the story.
And so he like reintroduced those devices into, and now they're at the official astronomy museum in Great Britain and all that. And so the first device was massive and became problematic when they were trying to fire cannons because they were down in the foxhole thing. And that was bad. So we made a second version and they were later renamed to be the H1 through H4 as the Harrison version 1 and Harrison version 2, 3, and 4.
Okay.
So the H1 was the initial one, and it was massive, and it was on this big box, and the box was on a mechanism that allowed it to rotate, so it minimized the amount of rotation that it had, and there was a little window into the bottom that he could see what time it was, and it was really close, and it gave them more accurate time than what they had, because they would use the time to say, okay, the sun is directly over us. It is now noon. Let's compare that with what the clock says. And so if the clock is set back to Greenwich Mean Time, which is at the longitude of zero, we know the difference between time between Greenwich and where we are. We can calculate that longitude. And so that was the magic, is he just needs to know exactly what time it is. And if they knew exactly what time it is, they'd know the latitude. And if they knew where the North Star was, they knew the latitude, and then they could
figure out where they were. So what is an easy way to remember which one's latitude and which one's longitude?
Giraffes have long necks and they go up and down. And so longitude are the ones that go up and down.
Okay.
On the map.
That's like how after years and years and years, I've never remember where the U in restaurants went, if it went in the middle or at the end. Rebecca, our friend Rebecca, says, the way I remember is that restaurants always end up with ants. Which is A-N-T-S, which is at the end of the word, not, and so the U is in the middle, R-E-S-T-A-U-R-A-N-T-S. So that's how I always remember that. And I just came up with something equally as ridiculous for another word that I now I can't remember. Anyway, restaurants always end up with ants. So Longitude have like a giraffe. They have like long necks that go up and down.
Exactly.
All right.
I think that was third grade for me. Like, that's I wasn't where listening
I
at third grade.
I was way. They did not have fidget cubes when I was a child, so there's not a whole lot right. I remember hearing. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and so he built the H1. He did the H2, which was the same technique and just smaller, and got a lot closer. The H3, same deal. Smaller. Closer, more accurate, but still not accurate enough, and being pushed back by this board as just not qualifying. And there were competitions going on. You know, this was $3.5 million, and right. So the lunar camp was out. You know, to and they had more political prowess and prestige, right. And so they were. Basically trying to get rid of John Harrison, and because he was just a lowly carpenter, he right. wasn't an esteemed astronomer like these special people of the elite. Right. And so he just toiled and dragged his son through this in just trying to make his son's life stable.
Right.
Like his only goal was... like be able to have an inheritance for my child, and so that was what the onus of him was, and he just had a passion for these timekeeping devices. Well, he devised a method of compensating for temperature adjustments in using a bimetallic strip in a pocket watch, and he. Commissioned this guy named Jeffries, last name was Jeffries, to build him a watch with his modifications built into it. And so this Jeffries watch became...
So did watches have little pendulums in them too, and that's why they couldn't work? Like they weren't springs or...
So there's a couple problems with the standard wind-up clocks. They do have little pendulum devices, but they're not... based on gravity. They're based on springs.
Right.
And so you can isolate those, and they just weren't accurate enough because okay. anytime there was a temperature change, the time changes because all the metal constricted right. and contracted and expanded. And so they were wildly inaccurate as compared to pendulum clocks.
Okay.
Also, there was another reason why I don't remember. And so the hand watch, the pocket watch that mm-hmm. he had made, he found. So, kind of as an aside, this wasn't a maritime device that he had commissioned from Jeffries. It was a personal pocket watch. Mm-hmm. It was slightly larger than normal, but he had this bimetallic strip put in there so that it would be better compensated for temperature controls. And that turned out to be wildly accurate. And he shifted, he totally pivoted his entire business that he had been working on for 40 years and said, that pendulum swinging thing and trying to compensate for the pendulum swinging thing isn't it. It's too bulky. It has too many factors that you're trying to compensate for. And he made basically a big wrist pocket watch. It's like 5 inches across,
like the iWatch.
Exactly.
Zing! Take that iWatch,
Apple Watch.
Sorry.
And so it was a 5-inch across pocket watch that had these temperature and humidity controls in it. And he also devised a technology in there that allowed you to wind it without interrupting the seconds that were flowing. So you okay. could add more energy to it without stopping the clock,
okay.
which was a problem with previous designs.
Right.
While you wound it, it stopped the second hand. Yeah, so that introduced more errors that you'd have to then correct for and
right.
calculate how do I...
Right.
How many seconds did I do?
Well, yeah, when you're talking trajectory, any tiny little bit off, you're...
Yeah, I mean, we're talking, you know, ultimately he came within 3 seconds over a period of like 2 months.
Wow.
And so incredibly accurate. And so the board gave him enough money to build. It kept going back and forth with, well, now you've got to do this, and now you've got to do this, and now you've got to do this. When he had solved the problem, he had proved that this was good. And they're like, now you need to disassemble it and show us all of your techniques for doing it so that we can prove that we can make more of them. And then you need to make two more, and both of those need to pass the test as well.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and he's. And he, at this point, is 76 years old in the 1700s, and he's dying.
Yeah.
He's literally dying. And
that's like 150 in today's years.
Totally. And he was just so passionate about this. And ultimately, the board gave him a portion of the proceeds in order to build this and did not give him the full amount, but an act of parliament did give him the money. And so 3 years before he died, he got the £20,000 in full. Basically, parliament gave him the balance that was due him,
right,
which at that point was like £13,000. And so he got the full amount. He lived the last decade of his life, including that first half and stuff,
as just a fairly riding around, riding around in his giant carriage, just flipping everyone off.
And so he did get his money.
What time is it now, bitches?
And so he did get his money. His son went off and got married and never made a timepiece again. Like he was fully
the son
done
who hated time.
Totally. And it really revolutionized maritime navigation. John Harrison died in 1776. And from that point on, that device was used. It was actually used for years before he died. Even Captain Cook used his devices. And Captain Cook came to his defense because Captain Cook had taken one of the devices that he had made and brought it on his ship as a second unit of navigation.
Okay.
And it was always much more accurate. And so Captain Cook's testimony helped sway Parliament to give him the reward. And so John Harrison, he's one of 100 best Britons in there's a list of
topmost
like,
Britons.
Top of, yes. And so he's a really significant historical figure that reshaped navigation as we know it for more than 100 years. Things became more and more refined from that initial concept. But he laid the groundwork. And, you know, there were plenty of other people working at the same time. He wasn't the sole person
sure.
that made a clock. But his advances were really, really significant. And
can you imagine if he saw one of those calculator watches that we used to have? He just showed up with that.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And you think of, like, how freaking at, you know, because our phones now synchronize with atomic clocks,
mm-hmm.
There, you know, we used to, as a child, I would call time. You would call,
that's
make
right.
the call number
to see exactly what time it was.
Yeah. And it, at the tone, the time will be, you know, 6:59:50.
It was the seconds that was exciting, because like if you did have the clock, you never got to see what seconds it was or to
right.
hear the exact second.
And then
is that after you're calling 411 for the number nearest you?
Right. And then in the early 2000s, I got a clock that synchronized with a radio signal would adjust itself.
Okay.
And then later on, now we just use our phone signals, have a time, you know, GPS and all
right.
these other things have atomically
synced
time. And so when like I work in an office of 30 people, and when there's a meeting invite for everybody and it's 10 minutes before the meeting, and you can hear, you know, everybody's
getting a notification
exactly the same time on their phone and on their computer and their iPad and everything.
That's so funny.
Because everything's in sync now.
Wow.
Thanks, John Harrison.
Nice. Well, speaking of storytelling, speaking of time, I wanted to play this little bit because there was an update. If you listen back maybe about a month or two ago, we did a show about a storyteller that came to yes. Nicholas's birthday party when we did the Dinner in the Dark. The show's called Dinner in the Dark. I don't know what number it is. But he ended the night and he was the storyteller. And so we told the whole story ourselves on the air about how ridiculous this was and how we kind of like couldn't believe he was like a person that people actually paid. And we were kind of wondering if like there was a con or something that we just kind of got taken in. Well, this past week, Nicholas notified us all.
He's a really nice guy.
As I just drag him through the mud. He has been awarded the Washington State Storyteller of the Year. So,
first of all, who knew that that was a thing?
A.
B. How many people are in the running for Storyteller of the Year?
Well, there's got to be at least two. The guy running it and then the one other guy he cajoled into paying the entry fee.
Yeah.
But I found a clip that we were listening to it a little bit beforehand, and I swear this is the exact same thing that he did in ours.
I don't think it is.
But you don't think it is, but you'll get the idea that, and he is talking about time here, which is a little more apt, but I'm going to play a little bit of our story. I won't say his name, I guess, now that I've just disparaged him. You can look up Washington State Storyteller of the Year and find yourself, but here's a little bit of a sample.
Once upon a time. It was once up on a time. It was once around a time and within a time. It was once between a time. Once above a time and below a time. Once within that time, there was another kind of time.
And that other kind of time was the time... the time we sat there listening to that for 100 hours.
Yeah.
Anyway... Awesome. No, I love hearing little stories like that about the people who did the building blocks of how we live today and you never hear about them, and to give them a little bit of their due. Well, fantastic. And you'll note if you listen back, I did not comment at all when you said onus, which is one of my favorite words. The onus is on you. That wraps it up for episode 80 of the Mark and Todd Cast. You can find all of our other episodes, including Dinner in the Dark, where we tell the full story of the wonderful storyteller, at markandtoddcast.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/markandtoddcast. You can drop us a note of corrections or omissions, or you can suggest some show topics, or just tell us that you are listening.
Chad Graham asks if those are bongos. No,
it was a drum you hold in between your knees.
It wasn't a didgeridoo, or no, not a didgeridoo,
which is not a drum at all.
It was not
a horn section.
No, it was a small, like a big cymbal. It was a hand drum, not bongos.
Right, yeah, so a handed drum, I think is where. But speaking of, I'm going to actually take us out with the Jaw Harp Boogie, which is a video I found on YouTube. So hopefully it will show where I can take this whole Jaw Harp thing. So thank you for listening. Spread the word. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Ooh, he uses his. He's got that whole thing in his mouth, doesn't he?
What? Really?
He's got the whole end, like from
the whole
here,
thing.
No, well, from here down, like pointed into his mouth.
Huh.
This is gonna be me all week long. All right, well, we'll see you guys next time.
Bye-bye.